Number three. When the sun came up on southeastern Idaho one day almost a year ago, it looked like the start of just another beautiful late spring day. It was Saturday, and two fishermen were looking forward to a relaxing day in the shadow of the new Teton Dam. The dam, over 300 feet high, had been completed the previous fall, except for a few finishing touches that remained, and had been gradually filling up with water during the winter. Now, due to the runoff from melting snow in the mountains, it was almost full. Further downstream from the dam, tens of thousands of people were going about their business. Some puttered around their houses doing weekend chores, while others were at work at businesses or on farms. But for the construction crew who arrived for work on the Teton Dam site that morning of June 5, 1976, it was a different story. At about 7:30 a.m., it was discovered that a sizable leak had sprung, not through the dam itself, but through the section of mountain on one side where the dam was anchored. This was reported immediately to the proper authorities, who directed that steps be taken immediately to start lowering the water level behind the dam. Why the leak had appeared so suddenly was a puzzle, since inspection of the dam by personnel around 9 o'clock the previous evening had turned up nothing wrong. But there was no time to solve this puzzle, because soon a second leak developed. Like the first, this second leak also appeared to break through the anchoring mountainside rather than the dam itself. Now the situation began to deteriorate at an alarming rate. Soon a leak found its way through the earthen dam itself, and a growing torrent of water gushed from it. Two bulldozers raced to that location to try to stop the flow by moving more earth into position. But the leak grew so fast that the bulldozers were lost, the operators leaping and scrambling to safety barely in time to save themselves. Like a nightmare come true, the Teton Dam crumbled, collapsed, and released tons of water into the valley below. The day ended abruptly in tragedy for the two fishermen and others who lost their lives as well. For 2 days, floodwaters from that ruined dam continued to spread, ultimately covering an area of 300 square miles, including several towns and 50,000 acres of farmland. One of the major purposes of the Teton Dam, like many others around our country, had been flood control. Now the man-made flood unleashed by the collapsed dam had caused damage estimated to be in the range of $350 to $500 million, in addition to the loss of life. The bursting of the Teton Dam provided America with a preview, on a very small scale, of what the Soviet Union plans to do to our entire country. Last month, in audio letter number 23, I reported hard intelligence I had received to the effect that 21 major lakes and dams in 10 western states have hydrogen Soviet bombs planted in them. But the information I gave you then, my friends, was only the beginning. Since recording audio letter number 23, I have been under an avalanche of ongoing intelligence reports concerning the ongoing Soviet program of planting nuclear weapons in our inland lakes and reservoirs. I can now reveal that this Soviet program began at a relatively slow, careful pace as much as 18 months ago. For example, a Soviet nuclear device was planted over a year ago at a dam known as the Dalles on the Columbia River east of Portland, Oregon, and it is still there now. The Teton Dam disaster appeared to be just a great big accident, but it brought to everyone's attention the fact that dams can be made to collapse under certain conditions and that the consequences are devastating. Meanwhile, the border of Idaho with Canada has become an important entry point for Soviet agents who are bringing nuclear bombs into this country. On Monday, May 16, I received an alert from my intelligence sources that Soviet agents were at that time in the process of transporting nuclear weapons into the northern United States by truck through several entry portals along the Canadian border. The greatest focus of that activity was at the Idaho entry points of Port Hill and Eastport. For the next several days, I was in frequent contact with my intelligence contacts in Canada, who were taking very definite action to find and stop these Soviet intruders. But here in the United States, our attention is being focused on our border with Mexico by the manufactured distraction of illegal immigrants. At the same time, we are undergoing a wholesale invasion along our border with Canada by the Soviet Union, and not one thing is being done about it by the United States. By late that first day, May 16, at least 16 Soviet vehicles carrying nuclear weapons were known to have crossed into the United States from Canada through entry portals into Idaho and Montana. Meanwhile, seven more were on Canadian Highway 3 from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, heading toward Port Hill and Eastport, Idaho, to enter the United States. By that time, the origination point in the Vancouver area had been narrowed down to a barge in Horseshoe Bay. The Canadians took care of the situation on their side of the border by stopping and inspecting trucks in the appropriate area. And by early May 18, all seven trucks driven by Soviet agents had been stopped and rounded up just short of the border. At that point, however, their next step was to wait for further instructions from Ottawa, and I have not yet been informed as to what further action was taken. Meanwhile, the only public hint of what was going on was contained in a short item printed in Vancouver newspapers on May 19. It stated that trucks were being stopped and searched along Route 3, but did not give the reason. For my Canadian friends, now you know. But it was a different and sad story here in the United States. The federal government is taking no action whatsoever, proving that there is a continuing collusion between the Rockefeller Empire and the Soviet Empire. At the state level, one would hope that the chances of obtaining action would be a little better, but so far, that has not been the case. Concerned citizens who have tried to bring my warnings to the attention of their governors and other high state officials have encountered basically two reactions. One is that, quote, this is something for the federal government, so we'll refer it to them, unquote. And of course, there it ends. The other main response is to the effect, quote, naturally, even if we did find a bomb in the lake next to the dam, we would not make it public. After all, we don't want to excite the people, unquote. But, my friends, that is like an air raid warden refusing to turn on the siren during an attack because it might frighten people. At the local level, though, one would hope that some action could still be expected, but no. During the period of May 16, I tried in every possible way to get local and state police in northern Idaho to simply check out some very specific reports I had been given, but to no avail. Several Soviet trucks were known to be heading southward in northern Idaho toward the town of Sandpoint, and I was informed of the approximate positions where it should have been possible to intercept them on the highway. But when I relayed these reports to state and local police in the area, both directly and through a brave local citizen in that area, it turned out to be impossible to persuade them to take action. As one police sergeant told me, quote, we're wondering why the federal government hasn't stepped in on this, unquote. And since they had not, even after being notified, the assumption was that there must not be anything to it. Therefore, it was not even going to be investigated. And so there, my friends, is a part of the handwriting on the wall for America. Most all Americans have been tricked into accepting the idea that only the federal government counts or is able to do anything, even though this idea is totally alien to our republic as originally founded. All the federal government has to do is not act or to remain silent about a matter such as Soviet missiles in our waters, and people conveniently leap to the conclusion that there must not be any missiles. As General Keegan says, we're becoming incapable of being warned. And my friends, if we don't snap out of it, we will suffer horribly. The fact that something was afoot in the area of our nation's water supplies should have been realized 4 years ago when Nelson Rockefeller started his National Commission on Water Quality. This he started at the same time as his much better known Commission on Critical Choices for Americans. And just as the Commission on Critical Choices was absorbed into the federal government in everything but name, the same was done with Rockefeller's Commission on Water Quality. But even if it was clear that water was to become a political tool in some way, I doubt that anyone in his worst nightmares imagined what was actually afoot. Over the past several years, federal and state water quality control boards have built up a comprehensive and up-to-date picture of our nation's water resources and requirements. And all this data has been turned over to the Soviet Union. So now the Soviets know exactly where and how to strike at us through our Achilles' heel of water, just as the Medes and Persians were able to calculate how to attack ancient Babylon through its water source. In the alliance between the Rockefeller and the Soviet Union empires, the Rockefeller brothers still want to rule the American continent under complete dictatorship. And the Soviets still want America to become their complete satellite, a nation of slaves. But the Rockefellers realized long ago that this country could not be brought under the total control they desire without the benefit of crushing disasters to force us into that mold. And the Soviets, for their part, realize that to extract the benefit from America that they seek, it is not enough simply to conquer us in war. Afterward, there must be a corps of turncoat managers, quislings, to run America for them. Soon, the Rockefellers expect to obtain the declaration of national emergency that they want in response to events which can be triggered by the Soviets. The declaration of national emergency, they believe, will make their dictatorship all but complete. At the present time, the Soviet Union has at least 158 underwater missiles in our territorial waters along our coastlines. In addition, the Great Lakes now bristle with smaller, single warhead Soviet underwater missiles, a total of 53 as of my latest information. The fact that the Soviet Union has been able to invade the Great Lakes and place missiles there is shocking. And it is even more shocking to know that Soviet agents are fanning out all over the United States, unhampered, to sow seeds of nuclear disaster throughout our land. It's hard for most people to imagine how such things are possible. But as I know from my own sources, they are being facilitated from within our country. For example, one of the key steps which has been taken by the Carter administration to permit these things recently was publicly confirmed by former Congressman John Rarick of Louisiana. Congressman Rarick publishes a very informative monthly newsletter entitled You Have a Right to Know, about which you might write to him at Drawer E, St. Francisville, Louisiana, zip 70775. Quoting from his March 1977 issue, the Soviets are hauling United States cargo in intracoastal shipping illegally against the provisions of the Jones Act. Russian vessels can be seen in the river loading from barges and also unloading onto barges as if they constitute an integral arm of the United States Maritime Service. Barges loaded by Soviets have been followed up the river through inland waterways and small canals to where their cargoes have even reached the Chicago market, unquote. Congressman Rarick further reports that the Soviets are able to get away with this because Secretary of the Treasury Blumenthal waived the provisions of the Jones Act as applied to Soviet vessels. Thanks to such generous help from within, The United States has been thrown wide open to offensive Soviet actions. As a result, the planting of nuclear devices in our inland waters, rivers as well as lakes and reservoirs, is mushrooming at a tremendous pace. To begin with, additional bombs have been planted in some of the huge dammed-up lakes that I named last month. For example, Hoover Dam had one bomb when I recorded audio letter number 23. But now it has three, one next to each end of the dam itself, the third upstream some distance from the dam. Another example is Oroville Reservoir in California. Last month it had one bomb. Now it has four. But more serious than this overkill of a few dams is the vast number of targets throughout America where Soviet bombs have been and are being planted. City water reservoirs of any significance throughout America are targeted. Many already contain bombs, while others are scheduled to receive bombs from the many trucks fanning out across America with Soviet agents at the wheel. Flood control, irrigation, and hydroelectric dams of all kinds are targets as well. And major rivers are also being seeded with bombs as strategic points. To indicate the magnitude of the Soviet attack plan, I will report the current status of just one state, Texas, which is a major target. As of my latest intelligence, over 100 bombs have already been planted in Texas, and I have been provided so far with a partial list that specifies 33 of the lakes involved. These are Toledo Bend Reservoir, Sam Rayburn Reservoir, Stein Helios Reservoir, Lake Vernon, two lakes northeast of Houston, which provide water for the city, Conroe Lake, Somerville Reservoir, Lake Waco, Lake Whitney, Malakoff Lake, Frankston Lake, Lake Livingston, Millwood Reservoir, Lake Texarkana, Lake of the Pines, Cedar Lake, Lake Tawakoni, four water reservoirs for Dallas and Fort Worth, Lake Texoma, Arbuckle Reservoir, Lake Bridgeport, Hubbard Creek Reservoir, Lake Kemp, Lake Arrowhead, Ofala Reservoir, San Angelo Reservoir, Twin Buttes Reservoir, Lake Thomas, and White River Reservoir. A number of rivers around the country are also known to be involved already. These include the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Illinois, the Ohio, the Columbia, the Potomac, and the Susquehanna. In the Mississippi alone, there are already 31 bombs located near dams and locks and other strategic points. The farthest to the north is a bomb about 5 miles downstream of Little Falls, Minnesota. From there, they have all been planted all the way down to New Orleans or Louisiana, where two bombs are in the river. There are also two other bombs near New Orleans at the east end of Lake Pontchartrain. My friends, the Soviet Union is striving to be in a position to suddenly, decisively, rob America of our water resources. While we are distracted with arguments over weapons delivery systems, such as bombers and missiles, the Soviet Union is striving for the reliability of weapons that are already on site at the target. When war comes, the Soviet Union plans to be able to just push a button, detonate nuclear weapons all over America, devastate our country with floods and the pestilence that they bring, and still have all their missiles and bombers still in reserve. But before war comes, the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance planned to lay the groundwork for a declaration of national emergency in the United States. One option still available to them is war in the Middle East, causing a cutoff of Arab OPEC oil supplies. But a horrendous new capability is now in place as an alternate means for creating our national emergency. And my friends, there are ominous signs that this capability is going to be used very soon. Lurking deep in the waters around the Philippine Islands, there are now 7 fission-fusion-fission bombs planted there by the Soviet Union. Such a bomb is essentially a hydrogen bomb with a jacket of uranium-238. When it's set off, the nuclear reaction converts much of the jacket material to plutonium-239, which in turn explodes as well. The Soviet Union is the only nation that has ever set off such a bomb, 16 years ago on October 30, 1961. In doing so, they set an ugly record that still stands, the biggest nuclear weapon ever fired in the atmosphere. Its yield was something over 50 megatons. That is 50 million tons of TNT, 2,500 times as large as the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Theoretically, there's no limit to the yield of such a bomb, but for 16 years, it has been thought of in the West as unusable because it produces such vast quantities of fallout that it would endanger the country that used it. But the Soviet Union has found a way to use it, deep under the ocean for geophysical warfare, in an environment where the radioactive products are relatively confined, producing little fallout. The Philippines sit like a keystone among a long arch of subsea trenches and faults that comprise the most earthquake-prone areas on Earth. Starting just north of New Zealand, a band of geological instability runs northwestward toward the Philippines, then northeastward past Japan to the Kamchatka Peninsula, eastward along the Aleutians to Alaska, and then southward along the west coast of the United States, Mexico, Central America, and onward all the way to Chile. This long, irregular zone around the Pacific Rim is often called the Ring of Fire. The 7 Soviet bombs planted in Philippine waters are there for the purpose of triggering major earthquakes, which, thanks to the peculiar convergence of faults and trenches in that area, are intended to work their way by chain reaction all around the Pacific Rim, devastating Washington State, Oregon, and California in the process. The 7 bombs in the Philippines are in the so-called gigaton range. That is, each one is equivalent to a billion tons of TNT, 50,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, and therefore big enough to trigger massive earthquakes. And the Soviets believe they can safely use such warfare, treaties or no treaties, because most of the Soviet Union has no history of earthquakes. The Soviet gigaton bombs in the Philippines are located at navigational coordinates, which I will now reveal. Number 1 is at 17, 23, 23 north, 117, 7, 23 east. Number 2 is at 14, 48, 48 north, 119, 2, 18 east. Number 3 is at 14, 0, 40 north, 118, 23, 53 east. Number 4 is at 13, 0, 0 north, 117, 42, 8 east. Number 5 is at 12, 0, 54 north, 126, 4, 55 east. Number 6 is at 13, 50, 36 north, 125, 21, 45 east. Number 7 is at 19, 48, 3 north, 123, 51, 57 east. But to make sure that our west coast is devastated by the effects of a seeming natural disaster erupting in the Philippines, a series of 7 conventional but large hydrogen bombs have been planted off our west coast by the Soviet Union. These can be set off in conjunction with those in the Philippines and at the right moment to produce tidal waves which would sweep in from the Pacific with devastating effect along our west coast. Bomb number 1, west of Seattle, is at 48-00 north, 127-50 west. Number 2, west of Eugene, Oregon, is at 43-29-18 north, 127-55-5 west. Number 3, west of San Francisco, is at 37-8-45 north, 125-42-30 west. Number 4, west of Monterey, is at 36-31-0 north, 125 26 30 West. Number 5, also west of Monterey, is at 36 26 30 North, 124 56 0 West. Number 6, west of Los Angeles, is at 33 25 15 North, 122 23 50 West. And number 7, southwest of San Diego, is at 31 45 35 North, 120 36 0 West. In my audio letter number 20 for January 1977, I refer to a warning document issued in December 1975 by Mr. Tony Hodges of Hawaii. In that document, Mr. Hodges presented evidence of the feasibility of underwater missiles. He also warned of the dangers of bombs on or in the seabed designed to generate earthquakes or tidal waves. Unfortunately, it turns out that Mr. Hodges' warnings were all valid. The dictatorship and war plans are being speeded up now. The world will be stunned by what will look like a massive natural disaster in the Philippines that also spreads around the Ring of Fire to decimate our West Coast. And when it happens, Jimmy Carter will have the excuse David Rockefeller wants him to have to declare a national emergency and, in effect, suspend the United States Constitution. The President's dictatorial emergency powers, spelled out in Executive Orders 11490 and 11921, will be activated, and the complete bureaucracy of dictatorship set in motion under circumstances designed to stifle all dissent. And the elaborate prescriptions for complete governmental control of all of our water resources, spelled out in Executive Order 11921, will be activated under conditions which enable this to be sold to the people as necessary for our best interest. Soon thereafter, with the Rockefeller dictatorship in place, nuclear World War I itself is planned to come. Dams and reservoirs all over America are to be destroyed at one blow by the Soviet Union. And the Quislings from the Trilateral Commission, who now control the federal government, will use their control over what little remains of our water supplies to make their domination of us total. The saddest thing about all this is that only when it happens will people believe. By total exposure, there is a chance to prevent the West Coast disaster. But without exposure, there is no chance whatsoever. My friends, it's only by the grace and power of our Lord Jesus Christ that I've received the information I revealed over the recent past. And it's my solemn duty to pass on this information to you. It's not meant for me alone. And in the same way, it's not meant for you alone. It needs to be known by everyone. And so, my friends, this completes 2 years of my monthly audio letters. I want to thank you for all your words of encouragement, your support, and especially your prayers. Again, thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.